This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Bees, they can be scary for some of us as we try to swat away any chance of being stung. But even if we're not exactly fans, bees are an incredibly important part of our ecosystem. One out of every three mouthfuls of food we consume is dependent upon bees' pollination efforts. And who doesn't love fresh honey? You can even have your own being produced in your yard, as long as you can get along with bees. Joining Cincinnati Edition to discuss the history of beekeeping and to talk about some current practices is apiculturist at the University of Miami's Ecology Research Center, Alex Zomchek. Welcome, Alex.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me down.
Questions, comments, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. Alex, you sent over some information for us as we were preparing for this segment. And I just wanted to note something that you wrote.
Uh-oh.
You say, I currently divide my honeybee time into three broad segments,
right?
Honeybee research, teaching, lecturing, workshops, and development of research apparatus and education materials. So it just struck me that you have one honeybee time, and that it's so extensive that you've divided it into these three areas. What is it about this insect that attracted you?
Yeah, I'm one of those lucky people. There's an old saying, return to the passions of your youth. So for me, it was a youthful experience at 10. I ran across a one-armed beekeeper who was an old World War I vet. And the best I can frame it is he was my Captain Hook. We got into some hives. He shows me some things. The fear, the flavor, you put it all together, hooked for life.
And so now you spend a lot of time researching them.
Yep.
And I referenced there at the beginning of this segment that one out of three mouthfuls of food that we consume is directly related to the work that bees do. Explain what that means exactly.
Yeah. We used to have small agricultural plots, mom and pop farms. And they served us well. They're very diverse. But as the country grew, our needs grew. And so a solution was going to wait, in the wings. So along comes the invention, the discovery of the American modern beehive. And that leads us to a simple solution. We could now take bees to the field. That leads us to have fields of infinite size. So now, fast forward to today, it's all about scalability. I mean, the food that we get at Kroger's is not coming from most of the small local farms, but from large agricultural or agribusiness plots. And in order to make those work, you have to have pollinators at scale. And because of the changing nature of the forest and the veg around us, you can't put 500 acres or 1,000 acres of a fruit or vegetable in and expect that you're going to get efficient pollination. So with taking bees from trees and putting them in the boxes, moving boxes to the fields, a solution came about where all of a sudden this codependent relationship actually where the number of bees needed to the amount of food that we produce and one out of three mouthfuls of food.
So you have this hive tray, and this is how this is introduced to basically agriculture, and now they're kind of a tool that that are just used in our daily lives.
Yep.
And we see regular neighborhoods all across the region with people who have taken to this practice. Yeah, because some won't allow it.
That's correct.
Yeah, so we saw, I think it was last year that the city of Hamilton decided that it was okay.
Bee-friendly.
Bee-friendly.
Yeah, there's some large movements on out there. Bee America, bee-friendly. And you do have to appreciate, I mean, even from my perspective, I'm one of those guys that having been in bee behavior for so many decades now, I got a good feel for what's happening in the hive on a given day. It never is lost on me that my neighbor looks over and in this box hears that there may be 60, 70, 80, 90,000 stinging insects all close to me. Do they pose a threat or don't they? And so there's a lot of hyperbole out there, but I find out that a lot of communities, again, given the very changing nature of the public's perception and view of beekeeping, let me put a mark there. 17, 20 years ago, if I was giving a lecture on bees, aside from the crickets in the room, that's about it.
Crickets and bees.
Today, when you put all that together, and I even ask myself, where does this passion, this public interest come from? And, you know, part of it's probably our youth, the Winnie the Pooh trees that we remember. Part of it is this growing understanding of the mortality or the die-off of bees, I think just from a sympathetic point of view. And then there's this public education where, for me, it's a simple equation. First of all, at the top level, bees equal food. Then for most of us, food equals health. And then if you want to get political about it, health equals healthcare system. So let's get back to high school algebra. Bees then equal part of the healthcare system. So if we're getting that extra serving of fruit or vegetables a day, which often now is correlated with reduced incidences of cancer and other types of diseases, that's coming from bees. So they do play, and again, the public is really beginning to slowly get a grasp that this whole thing is connected, and it's not just about honey on my biscuits anymore. It's a much bigger story than that.
Do you think people around here understand beekeeping's unique history and connection to Oxford?
Well, you know, I wish I could say that, because, you know, we go through so many students every year at Miami University where they've never heard this story, and I understand. But Oxford, Ohio is bee mecca. There's only one. It's the place where we literally took, after tens of thousands of years of experience with bees, humans with bees, we were first honey hunters, slowly became beekeepers. And then after all of that kind of discombobulated time, it's kind of like the Wright brothers. Somebody came along. This was L.L. Langstroth in the 1850s in Oxford, Ohio, and said, hey, and literally discovered how honeybees worked and took them from trees and put them in a beehive. So that happened in Oxford. There's only one place. It was like as if Steve Jobs had invented the iPhone right down the street here. So funny that you should ask that. I had a couple come in this spring who literally came all the way from Germany, a beekeeping couple, because they had to come to the Langstroth Cottage, a historical marker in Oxford. And it reminded me again that, one, a lot of local people don't know the history, and yet there are a lot of people out there in the know about bee history. So
I want to say your title again. It's apiculturist?
Yeah, apiculturist or apiculturist.
Okay, so I said apiculturist, and I think our producer was saying, no, it's a long A.
It depends on what state you're from. It's apis, it means bee in Latin, and so one who studies bees.
Well, in any event, we're talking to Alex Zomchek from the University of Miami. He is an apiculturist or an apiculturist. And 513-419-7100 is the number to call if you have questions or comments for him. Let's go to the phone lines now. We have Alex on the line. Hi, Alex. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I was just wondering, in regards to diets like veganism and, you know, a lot of the people I know don't eat honey, whether it's because of the practices of how it's manufactured. So I wonder what the speaker would like in beekeeping too, whether it's more of a industrial, you know, like farm, or if it's something like backyard chickens, you know?
Yeah, you know, of
thanks for the call, Alex. We'll hang up and we'll let Alex here answer the question. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Alex, for the question. If there was one last night I was thinking about on this show that I didn't want to answer, that was it.
The veganism?
The veganism. Because there isn't a clear answer, and there's a lot of misinformation out there. Unlike other processed foods, honey is a complete natural food. You don't have to do anything to it. You harvest it from the hive. And again, if it's done responsibly, which in most cases it is, they save a lot, you take a little, and it's a wonderful symbiotic relationship. So the idea that we're consuming honey and that, and again, all respect due to veganism as a philosophy, I don't see the harm. I don't know how we cross that threshold because, again, responsible beekeeping means reasonable harvest, leaving the bees to themselves. And it would be no different than picking an apple off a tree and saying, boy, I've somehow inflicted some sort of damage or harm on this tree. And I don't want to belittle the topic. It's an important topic. But I don't find a good weighted argument to make this anti-vegan.
And I guess Alex also asked about comparing beekeeping to raising backyard chickens.
Yeah. Well, we've been around a lot longer. And that argument is made, by the way, when we want to get bees into local communities, the agricultural laws that persist, we usually ride the feather tails of chickens on the legal side to come in and allow us to put beehives in the area. Unfortunately, they're avians, we're insecta. The problem with that is by the time they throw the chickens out for all the noise and the whatnot, they throw the bees out too. And so be careful about that relationship if you're trying to approach your city ordinances and ride on that. So in many respects, from a hobbyist, a colonialist point of view, a long history, farmers raising other small animals over here and bees over here. So, yeah, there's a great relationship there.
And we got a question from Adam via Twitter. He says he's seen bee houses at some of the big home centers, and he's wondering whether those are good to use, and really, what are they?
Yeah, those are usually to just show the general public. There's one manner or another of observation hives where we try to make it kind of through the looking glass so you can get a real feel. A typical hive is this dark enclosure, an observation hive or a larger observatory bee house is made to show the public. So it's a little bit of an artificial environment. It's like looking at animals in the zoo versus in the wild. But again, those are just kind of constructs outside the beehive to let the general public see a little more. It's a little unnatural, but the bees seem to work with us on that. So
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you have a question. Let's go now to Tim. He's on the line. Hi, Tim. What's your question or comment?
Hey, before I get into this, first I want to say, Michael, kudos to you on the variety of topics on the show, covering Ohio and Kentucky kind of equally. It's appreciated, and I look forward to listening.
Well, thank you for that, Tim, and I have to give a big shout-out to our producers, Pete and Selena, and our technical director, Josh, who put a lot of these segments together. I just show up and talk into the microphone most of the time, and I appreciate you listening, Tim.
Well, I'm going to depress you real good. So I have a question. You know, we hear about the decline of the bee population, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better, but I hear maybe we've turned it around because people realize maybe Roundup was contributing to the decline along with other things. I mean, is there any hope that bees are going to be... I mean, I'll be honest, when I see a bee in my lawn, I get excited because when I was growing up, I saw them everywhere, and now you never see them, and it's depressing. So hopefully there's hope.
Well, thanks for the call, Tim. We'll let Alex take a gander at that.
Well, Michael, where there's life, there's hope, right? So, yeah, there is hope. Very shortly, succinctly, you mentioned Roundup, glyphosate. This is a problem. But when we put it all together, what bees are facing today is about 4 to 5 major things. Lack of proper forage, veg for them to feed on, certainly a variety of things. We've kind of gone into mono agriculturalism, so even our bees are getting a very thin diet. The other problem is insecticide, pesticide issues, or environmental toxins. Another big important element is just even bee genetics that have kind of gotten watered down over time. And lastly, part of the big quadro here is mites and associated pathogens, bacterial and viral. So when we pick on just one thing, we've got to be careful. There are several big circles on our Venn diagram, and they're all kind of circling and working and maneuvering together. So we're trying to separate them and pick on them. So if we want to pursue this, I have depressive days, weeks, even months. But I'll say this, after 40-plus personal years in beekeeping, given the number of things that other people are doing, some of the things that I'm doing in terms of genetic research that takes us all the way to artificial insemination and beyond, there's definitely the light in the hope tunnel is much, much brighter than it's been in the last several years.
We got another question via Twitter. Sure. Asking, how does this woman keep her neighbor's bees from bothering the hummingbirds at her feeders?
The practical questions, the water feeders, the swimming pools, the hummingbird feeders. I'm lucky. I tag a lot of my bees, believe it or not. We put numbers and tags on them to follow them. So basically, I tell my neighbors, if it doesn't have my name on it, don't call me. But the fact of the matter is, there are hummingbird feeders out there that are actually now bee retardant. They can let the hummingbirds in but keep the bees away. And this usually occurs, by the way, just become fascinated by it. We're all living in the same ecosystem. And the bees come to the hummingbird feeders during the summer dearth. So that's usually a kind of a midsummer problem. And all I can say from a beekeeper's perspective is a little sugar water going to hurt you?
We've only got about 90 seconds left, unfortunately, so I'll try to get you to answer a couple more questions quickly. What about allergies? We got a question from Beth who called in. Is it true that consuming locally produced honey can help with allergies?
Yeah, see, the tough questions that you throw out here. You know, I want to jump on that utility bandwagon, that kind of urban myth legend. There's some science behind it. Look, if you have an allergic reaction, you're having it, or a histamine reaction, it's usually due to something in the local environment, local pollen, for instance. So bees collect pollen, and if you ingest that pollen, the theory goes that perhaps you can trigger your immune system to develop a sort of autoimmune acceptance or tolerance over time. But the fact of the matter is that the human gut does not digest pollen well as a protein. And so there isn't even that much pollen in the honey that we get. There's pollen and then there's honey. And the bees keep them separate, we keep them separate. So there's still some science to be done on massive consumption of pollen. And I know some weightlifters and model runway models use them as a protein supplement. But in terms of the hard science for allergen and histamine reactions, stick with your Claritin for now.
All right, 15 seconds left. What about the impact of almond production on honeybees?
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. We use almonds first in the spring. We literally take about 2.2 million beehives from around the United States to pollinate one of our first pollinating crops in Southern California. And it's interesting, our thirst, our hunger for almonds have literally led us to planting hundreds of thousands of acres of almonds, which benefit from pollination.
We'll have to leave it there, I guess.
Okay.
I appreciate the appearance today, Alex Zomchek from Miami University for Talk. We'll have to have you back for sure. This was a great subject. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks.